You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Restaurants all across Los Angeles are full of people like Jonathan. He came out to LA to pursue his dream, to be a screenwriter and make movies. But as the story goes, in order to make ends meet, he spent the last 15 years working in restaurants, bussing tables, serving food, interacting with people from all over the city. Well, COVID-19 has messed all of that up.
It was a little bit like 9/11. Like, you never forget where you were when you were told it's like, we're going to have to close. And then it became this sort of like people were crying, and you could see how scared everyone was because they would be trying to guess on how long this is going to go on. It can't go on for more than 2 weeks. It can't go on for more than a month.
We're not using his last name or the name of the Hollywood restaurant where he works because he's afraid of losing his job, like a whole lot of other people. With much of life in Los Angeles shut down, Jonathan felt he was stuck. With no real work left to speak of, he turned to unemployment. Well, that money, plus a $1,200 stimulus check, did help, at least a little. So when he heard LA County would be reopening its restaurants and maybe even bars in the days to come, he was faced with no other choice but to go back, even if the idea of spending hours inside a restaurant scared him.
But now the unemployment's ending, and you got to do something. There's 20% unemployment, and it's not like you're going to change jobs. So you're probably going to have to put on a face shield and a mask and go back into that dangerous situation.
And that's exactly what Jonathan and thousands of others in Southern California did as the gates of nightlife swung open back in June, just last month. Well, as you know, things have changed again. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo talked to Jonathan and other restaurant workers who feel they put their lives on the line to help the economy recover just to see it all close back down again last week. Spoiler alert, they're not particularly happy about it.
Returning to work was a taxing affair for Jonathan. To keep patrons safe, the restaurant where he works at installed plexiglass separators, dining groups were spaced out at least 6 feet away from one another, and hand sanitizer was made available for those who needed it. And really, there was so much more to do than before.
Every time you clear a table, it's rubber gloves and forethought about every motion you're making. And then you drop off the dirty plates and you take the gloves off like a doctor and you clean your hands and sing happy birthday for 20 seconds. And you do that 50 times a day.
Management did offer him and his coworkers some personal protective equipment, which included masks and gloves, plus a cheap plastic face shield, though he did end up buying a better version online.
The actual working is terrible. It's really hard because the face mask is sort of fine and easy. The face shield is a nightmare. It is hot. You can't see. You can't hear. They're not very transparent. You're in it for hours. You're kind of happy to have it because it does feel fairly safe to have those sort of layers of protection against you and the guests.
As he acclimated to life inside his restaurant, Jonathan came to realize he was most concerned about catching COVID-19 from his coworkers.
You're just around them all the time. There's no social distancing at that point. You just can't. It's not possible. And they're wearing a mask and you're wearing a mask and most of them are wearing shields if they're waiters or whatnot. And so it's probably not that bad, but you definitely just get the feeling like, wow, it's just seconds away from getting me.
Plus, sometimes it didn't seem like they were even trying to keep the virus from spreading. One day, Jonathan saw most of his fellow staff and a manager sitting at a table during a break, without masks on. They sat there for about an hour. Jonathan later brought it up with his manager.
I said, if any one of those people at that table with you have coronavirus, and with the numbers at what they are, it's likely that somebody does, you absolutely have it. And I said, you promised us a safe work environment, and that was not safe.
For other restaurant workers, coworkers aren't the biggest concern. It's the guests they're afraid of.
I mean, I'll tell you straight up, no one in Orange County is social distancing. No one is wearing masks. And the only people that were required to wear masks or any kind of PPE were employees. And the amount of people that they were letting into the bar was beyond, like they were packed like sardines. That's just the honest truth.
Julian started a new job at a bar and grill in coastal Orange County just a couple weeks ago. Like Jonathan, he's also worried about losing the job, so we're not using his last name or the name of the business. It's his first job out of college. He graduated from UCLA with a degree in theater. And on Thursday, a few days after he started the job, he was diagnosed with COVID-19. His story is similar to others we've already heard, which started as a light fatigue turned into a sore throat. And within a day, that sore throat turned into a full-blown fever. Now, he's been grappling with an illness he doesn't know he'll walk away from. He suspects, but can't prove, he got the virus at work. And though he followed the rules, he isn't sure whether he spread it to others at the bar. Julian technically worked as security, but his job didn't stop there. Food running, drink running, picking up trash, and sanitizing surfaces, they were all part of his job. Before coming down with the virus, he had already considered quitting.
Especially, I feel like, as security slash everything, we are the ones that are most exposed. Because the kitchen stays in the kitchen. The bartenders, for the most part, stay behind the bar, as well as the bar backs. We're the only ones constantly walking the floor. So we're certainly the ones most at risk and getting paid less than anyone else. Just not worth it.
Like Julian, a waiter named Matthew, again, no last name to protect his job, felt the restaurant environment could be dangerous for him. He's worked as a waiter for the last 8 years, and today, he's the sole breadwinner in his house. His girlfriend is currently in school. He's gone back to work at a restaurant in Santa Monica because he feels he has no other choice.
You get the sense that the workers aren't taken care of enough. You know, like, I'm not a medical worker. I'm not saving people's lives. I'm serving food and drinks. You know, I'm around a ton of people all day. You know, I don't know who's looking out for me. You can definitely feel like a grunt. You have to show up and you have to work. I don't have another option. It can be very frustrating and it can make you feel disposable, that's for sure. We all seem to feel very similar about having to put our, you know, our health on the line just to keep things running. It doesn't feel heroic, I should say. It doesn't feel noble.
It doesn't help, but the pandemic seems to make customers a little grumpier than they used to be.
In a restaurant, if you make a little mistake, normally, you know, you fix it. People are usually pretty understanding and, you know, adaptable. Lately, most of my coworkers, including my managers, have really dealt with a lot of anger. I mean, people exploding sometimes, swearing at you.
Matthew even had one patron call him a thief. It had apparently taken them too long to return his change. But what it all comes down to is this. All the service industry workers I've talked to are fed up. They're tired. They're scared. And they're discouraged by a sense that no one seems to care about them. Here's Jonathan again.
The federal government, at least, doesn't care. Just could care less. In fact, considers you to be almost cattle. You just get back out there. You gotta pull the economy together. You have to do this, not us. You are the heroes of this story. Get back out there and get on the line. And I'm gonna go play golf. It's completely maddening.
For Julian, who's got COVID-19, he faces a crisis of conscience. Before his time at UCLA, he spent 5 years in the Marine Corps. While growing up in Florida, he loved his country and wanted to do the most he could for it.
I was raised with the concept that America is the greatest country on earth, with the concept that there's something special about America, that we are an example to the rest of the world. And that's just completely evaporated because it's kind of completely destroyed the image of what I thought America was.
Meanwhile, Matthew was still at work. The restaurant where he works at has outdoor seating, so it's still allowed to stay open. Public officials say restaurants will stay closed for dine-in for at least another 2 weeks. That means workers like Jonathan will once again rely on unemployment benefits, which are set to expire at the end of the month. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguayo.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, as the waitstaff across Southern California struggles to find a balance between making ends meet and avoiding the pandemic, something else is going on in the food industry, namely in food media. Amid accusations of a culture of discrimination against people of color at Bon Appetit magazine, its editor-in-chief, a guy named Adam Rappaport, resigned. And closer to home, just last week, the food editor at the LA Times, Peter Meehan, resigned amid fiery accusations of its own. Now, both resignations are part of a larger scope of problems being cited at media companies that include abuse of power, racism, pay inequity, discrimination, sexism. Mona Holmes writes for Eater LA. She's a regular contributor for Greater LA, and she's been following these stories. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
I want to talk about this trend of resignations in food media. The news broke last week that Peter Meehan was stepping down as food editor at the LA Times, a role that he only took in the past few years as the Times revamped its food section. Why did he leave?
Well, his resignation was a complete shock in Los Angeles media last week. And this all came out because of a New York-based writer named Tammy Teclamarian, who spoke out about Peter Meehan on Twitter. And it turns out that she had conversations with present and former LA Times staff, and the results were not good. He came on board to the LA Times in 2018. He had a really good tenure after starting Lucky Peach magazine, this very stylish food magazine that was launched by him and also the chef owner of Majordomo in Chinatown, David Chang. And it had a nice run. It stopped publication in 2017. And when he arrived in 2018, he revived the weekly printed food section. He expanded the LA Times editorial crew by hiring Bill Addison and Patricia Escarcega as restaurant reviewers. And then he beefed up the team by adding Genevieve Coe and Ben Mims as part of the cooking and recipes team. So, but according to her interviews, Tammy's interviews with present and former staff, he also brought with him an aggressive behavior, favoritism, some said disorganized management style, and according to one of the LA Times staffers on Twitter, sexual harassment.
Meehan, by the way, is denying these allegations, but I'm curious what you may have heard about his behavior there. Anything that you know?
Well, as in any city's food section, you do wonder what your competitors are up to and how things are going for them, especially when there's a big management change. And the one thing that stood out to me was how quiet staffers were about Meehan. And that just struck me as unusual. And I had no idea that the behavior was this bad. And the two of them are somewhat related to me, in my opinion. But also that behavior was confirmed by many of the staffers on social media. And even with another former Test Kitchen writer, Noelle Carter, who was forced out before his tenure there, and her experience of being forced out was brutal. And there's even the ones who shared or stated that Meehan just fostered a work environment that was abusive. It was belittling, disorganized, and, you know, it was apparently not a great place to work.
And some of the folks there were not happy with the fact that he's living in New York and doing his job from there.
I believe that is something that a lot of people, even outside of the LA Times, had questions about. We did, even over at Eater. Why did LA Times management hire someone from New York to run LA's food section? And I grew up here. I am still learning up about the many pockets throughout the city. And as you know, any neighborhood in any city has personalities. They have history. They are constantly evolving. So to understand a city, you really need to have your feet and your ear on the ground. That's one. And then number two, he traveled from New York to Los Angeles once a month on the LA Times dime. And for those of us with colleagues and friends in other sections of the LA Times, some consider this a serious slap in the face for reporters who are now required to take one day a week off because of recent furloughs. So I think it's not, his entire presence wasn't necessarily a welcome one.
So the LA Times has lost a couple of prominent leaders from their food section for very different reasons. The late and much beloved Jonathan Gold, who passed away sadly a couple of years ago, and now Peter Meehan. I wonder where this leaves the LA food world.
Well, Los Angeles in general is now without a leader at the helm of a prominent food section at a time when the city desperately needs an editor who's thoughtful, who's qualified, and in the LA Times case is actually from here or has spent ample time getting familiar with the city and the cities within it. So Los Angeles Times management should make sure that more voices are representative to, so that Southern California's diverse traits, our food trends, our stories are written for the people who clearly want it. So that's where it leaves the food world. I think that for a city this size, this scope, and, you know, I mean, we have 77 miles of coastline. We've got over 10 million people here. We need to have these voices to be able to tell these stories. And right now, I imagine that it's a little bit uncertain over there at the very well-staffed food section. Those are incredibly talented writers, and they deserve to have to keep writing stories, but with an editor who's worthy of them.
So we've talked about a couple of outlets, Bon Appetit and the LA Times, being accused of having this culture, a toxic culture for some of its employees. Is this indicative, Mona, of a broader culture in food media? I mean, if so, why here? I mean, all types of food from all cultures are celebrated these days. Pakistani, Iraqi, Mexican, Chilean. Folks are hungry for this wide array of cuisine. So why wouldn't the media surrounding food be just as diverse as the food that they cover?
That's a great question, Steve. But it's a question that food writers have been having for a long time. Soleil Ho, who writes at the San Francisco Chronicle, wrote about Bon Appetit's problems well before Adam Rappaport's resignation. And I've read actually multiple articles from her about this and from others who say that it's a problem that they've witnessed, myself included, getting higher ups to see that there are more voices of what people actually want to see, view, and hear. But I'd say that it's overall a systemic problem. And it affects what's shown, what eyeballs are drawn to my own site or on the radio. It's you just see it. I mean, there's even an example with Peter Meehan, who refused to have anything related to Juneteenth in the LA Times food section. It's the holiday celebrating emancipation of those who were enslaved in the U.S. until management stepped in. And so, you know, until those changes are actually made, those systemic changes are made from an editorial level, at a fundamental level, those kind of voices, those diverse, wide array of cuisines that everyone wants to know about won't get seen unless management at any publication starts to take their value seriously. So it's, and it's not just in food. Organizations throughout the country, even my own, are figuring out how to make their mastheads more diverse. And, you know, you would think that everyone wants to know about these things, but there still are gatekeepers who are very powerful and have enormous influence over what we see.
And this at a time, Mona, when the restaurant industry is just hurting so badly.
It is. Terribly. I mean, I desperately believe that Los Angeles deserves better. We need to know these stories about what's happening to these restaurants, many that are closing up shop and will never see again because of COVID and closures and social distancing. And for us to learn about those stories, we need a fully staffed food section at not only Eater LA, but the LA Times, LA Magazine, the Long Beach Post, any of these major publications. They need to have these stories so that we can know who to support, what's happened to them, anything that's coming out. It's just vital that we get this.
Wanted to ask you about the story you heard earlier in the program from our reporter, Danielle Chiriguayo, about restaurant employees working so hard. We're talking about the waitstaff, bussers, bartenders, a lot of folks who are interacting with people. By the way, customers who may or may not have masks on. We know the restaurant workers do, but the customers may not. What do you think about that?
Oh, Steve, it's been my concern since March and since dining rooms have reopened. If we're really being honest, even with delivery and takeout, I am friends with someone who works at a prominent West Side restaurant, which had to close twice because one or more employees tested positive for COVID. I mean, it's such a gamble. And it's a question that should be repeated. I mean, how do you keep your restaurant staff healthy anytime that they come into contact with so many other people than those of us who are lucky enough with the choice of being able to work from home? And I'm always asking the question, is it really worth it for those working? And oh my God, hearing about the restaurant workers in Orange County whose customers just don't wear masks, And I feel pretty strongly about this. I think it shows how these customers really feel about the health and welfare of servers, bussers, bartenders, cooks, and all the people who make a restaurant work. I find it deeply troubling. If this is a minor step that anyone has to take to keep someone else healthy, why not do it?
You know the old adage about dating someone and how they treat the restaurant staff, right?
Oh, like
Stay away from those folks. Yeah.
Would love to know how they tip too.
Mona Holmes, our regular contributor to Greater LA, who writes for Eater LA. Mona, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. The George Floyd protests have got a lot of people reflecting on many aspects of life and culture and how they've been shaped by race. That includes the so-called built environment. We've talked about it on this show before, how infrastructure, housing, economic opportunity here in Los Angeles and pretty much everywhere else in this country have for decades been designed in ways that reinforce systemic racism. And few Black Americans have had the chance to participate in the design of their surroundings. Well, one who did is the late Paul Revere Williams, architect of hundreds of buildings that shaped L.A. Well, now his archive of work has been acquired by the Getty Research Institute and the USC School of Architecture. Francis Anderton, host of KCRW's Design and Architecture, joins me now to talk about it. Hey, Francis.
Hello, Steve.
Who is Paul Williams? You and I have talked about him before.
Well, this was a gentleman who was actually born in the 19th century, 1894, in downtown Los Angeles. He was orphaned at age 4, encouraged by his foster mother to follow his dream of becoming an architect. Went to LA public schools, took engineering classes at USC, worked as a draftsman in established Los Angeles architectural firms. And he went on to establish his own firm in 1921. He became a member of the American Institute of Architects in 1923, making him the first Black member of that professional association. He designed hundreds of buildings in LA, the LA County Courthouse, the first AME church, renovations to the Beverly Hilton, Saks Fifth Avenue, Palm Springs Tennis Club, and the Golden State Mutual Life Insurance Building. He also famously designed many private residences for the celebrities of Hollywood's golden age. Think Frank Sinatra, the comedians Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. Jana Ireland is a photographer who has a book coming out later this year that's devoted to Paul Williams' houses.
He designed buildings for very wealthy people, but he also designed public housing projects. He designed tract homes for Black GIs returning from World War II. He designed homes for middle-class families. He published 2 books of floor plans that people could use to build their own homes without having to hire him, but to have a Paul Williams house.
And this man also was very active in civic commissions. He even served on the National Housing Commission in the 1950s at the invitation of President Eisenhower. He died in 1980 at the age of 85, and he was given a posthumous American Institute of Architects Gold Medal back in 2017.
Can you imagine, Francis, the things that this man saw in his lifetime? Born in the late 19th century, lived through so many decades. It was not a great time to be a Black American, right? Especially in the Deep South, but also even in Los Angeles. There were places that were redlined, were many places where Black Angelenos would not be welcome. You make his career sound easy, but there must have been some really big challenges for him, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And he was working for white clients at a time when he himself might not be welcome at their homes or social gatherings. Milton Curry, Dean of USC, which co-acquired this archive, told me that Williams was a person who, in Curry's words, developed innovative strategies to move through the world in a way that he created a path for his own success.
So by drawing upside down, by developing strategies not to have to sit in close proximity to a client, folding his hands behind his back so as not to make people feel uncomfortable for not wanting to shake his hand. I think these are the strategies that he used in his time, and I'm sure that he comported himself in a way that exuded the utmost integrity and class.
That's just an extraordinary thing to hear, those changes that he had to make so people wouldn't feel like drawing upside down. Talk about drawing upside down.
I know. It's crazy, isn't it? Now, this is a man who was noted for his incredible drawing abilities. He trained himself to be able to draw a house upside down so that he could sit across from his clients in the event that they did not want to sit beside him. Now, Williams himself noted that at times his skin colour could be an advantage for him because it could attract people by his difference. He wrote about this in a heralded essay in American Magazine in 1937 called I Am a Negro. Now, he also wrote that while his early career was defined by trying to convince people to consider him an individual rather than a member of a race, he wrote, quote, I encountered irreconcilables who simply refused to give me a hearing, but on the whole, I have been treated with amazing fairness.
Clearly, Francis, his reputation has grown over time, but was his contribution to architecture in any way downplayed because of his race?
Well, that's certainly possible. However, I will say that architects who get a lot of attention do tend to be those that perhaps invent a new approach to architecture or a new style, or they become noted for a very specific style. Paul Williams wasn't like that. He was incredibly versatile. This was a man who designed in a wide range of styles: Mission, Regency Revival, Art Deco, stripped down modern, space age modern. And he designed in a way that his granddaughter, Karen Hudson, who's been managing his legacy for years, described as elegantly understated. Now, that can mean that it's not showy or flamboyant, and the press does tend to be attracted to the more showy examples of architecture. But it is fascinating how his reputation has changed over time. Jana Ireland, who we heard from earlier, the photographer, she says you can really see this when you look at newer editions of a classic guide to LA architecture.
I found that in one from 1977, when Paul Williams was still alive and had just retired, he's mentioned in passing four times. And then when you go to the most recent edition, the 2018 edition, he pops up something like 30 times in the book, and he's spoken of in much more positive terms.
What does it mean, Francis Anderton, for the profession of architecture, you know, and especially Black architects now?
Well, it sends a very powerful signal to a profession that, unfortunately, like many other professions, has not come as far as it should have done in terms of representation. Black architects currently make up a minuscule 2% or so of the total number of American architects. And there are a number of reasons for this. Architecture typically favors the rich. It involves a lot of money. The public school system doesn't push students towards architecture, but the profession understands that this is essential to change. And this is particularly important given how much buildings shape our lives and our well-being, I would say.
Certainly, certainly so. The Getty and USC acquire his archive, the archive of his work. Tell us about that.
Well, this is quite a colossal archive. Think 35,000 plans or so, 10,000 original drawings, blueprints, hand-colored renderings, vintage photographs of his buildings, correspondence. And this archive is joining some other important archives that the Getty is acquiring. They have the archive now of Frank Gehry, of John Lautner, Welton Beckett, who was LA's major mid-century corporate architect. And Maristella Casciato, who's the curator of architecture at the Getty Center, says that adding Paul Williams to this collection is very important for our understanding of Los Angeles.
If I have Welton Beckett, and I can pair Welton Beckett with Paul Williams, I will be able to see such a spectrum of the profession in Los Angeles by the first big corporate office, Welton, and the first African-American who was principal of his own office.
So it's a very important acquisition, also for another reason. The Getty has launched something called the African American Art History Initiative. Back in 2018, this got kicked off. They helped acquire the storied Ebony and Jet magazines photo archives. They also hold the archive of the artist Betty Saar, of Robert Farris Thompson and the Harry Drinkwater Photography Collection. So they're building up an important collection here. So while the news of the acquisition of the Paul Williams archive feels like it's almost timed to this moment that we're in, it's actually been in process for quite a while, says Maristella Casciato.
So you see, it starts in a way under a low profile, even before thinking, what is the acquisition? How do we deal? How we secure those drawings in an archival condition that in the future, for perennity, people can come, look at them, study them, write about them, write about Paul Williams. So it's a long journey, but it has been worth doing the journey.
Can you see the archive, Frances?
Yes. Eventually, you absolutely will. The archive has to be processed and catalogued, and that will take a while. But once it's available, anyone can make an appointment to see it. Also, a lot of the material is going to be available online, which means everyone everywhere can get to see it. And Maristella Casciato says they're planning an exhibition. They hope this will travel the world, introducing people everywhere to the work of this very important Los Angeles-based Black architect.
And by the way, anytime you fly into LAX, you can see, you know, his work. He and other architects built the theme building in the middle of that giant airport.
Yes. No, Paul Williams is an extremely important part of Los Angeles built fabric. And it's a thrill that this archive has been acquired.
Frances Anderton runs KCRW's design and architecture desk. Frances, thanks.
You're so welcome, Steve.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, a new Instagram account with thousands of followers. It's calling out racial discrimination and insensitivity at museums across the country. No one seems to know who's behind it. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us what you think. Are you, as you heard earlier on this program, on the front lines of an economy that can put your health at risk? We'd love to hear from you. And of course, you can subscribe to the podcast as well at Greater LA. That's kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Varnes, Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Kat Yor, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this show today. I'm Steve Giotakis, wishing you a good night.